I love monster movies. I simply adore monster movies, and the cheaper they are, the better they are. And cheapness, in the case of a monster movie, has nothing to do with the budget of the film, although it helps. But true cheapness is exemplified by invisible nylon strings attached to the jaw of a giant spider. I'll tell you a good one that I saw one time. I think the name of the film was It Conquered the World. And do you ever see that one? The monster looks sort of like an inverted ice cream cone with teeth around the bottom. It's like a teepee or a sort of a rounded off pup tent affair. And it's got fangs on the base of it. I don't know why, but it's a very threatening sight. Then he's got a frown and, you know, ugly mouth and everything. And there's this one scene where the monster is coming out of a cave, see? There's always a scene where they come out of the cave at least once. And the rest of the cast, it must have been made around the 1950s. The lapels are about like that wide. The ties are about that wide. They're about this short. And they always have a little revolver that they're going to shoot the monster with. And there's always a girl who falls down and twists her ankle. Of course there is. You know how they are. The weaker sex and everything, twisting their ankle on behalf of the little ice cream cone. Well, in this scene, folks, they didn't want to retake it because it must have been so good they wanted to keep it. But when the monster came out of the cave, just over on the left-hand side of the screen, you can see about this much 2x4 attached to the bottom of the thing as the guy is pushing it out. And then, obviously, off-camera, somebody's going, "No, get it back." And they drag it back just a little bit as the guy's going, now that's cheapness, right? And this is cheapness here.
that was a beautiful performance. That was...
It was a massage.
A massage, exactly. It has a title, though. It says Invocation and Ritual Dance of the Young Pumpkin. That's from a very early album, Absolutely Free. Probably a well-known album in the Zappa world. No, I mean in the world that wasn't involved with Zappa. They have, many people have heard some parts of Absolutely Free through the years if they were just brushing up against Zappa. But what I did there, what they've never heard before, is Frank doing the introduction to Cheapness, the monster movie montage. And right when he says, and this is Cheapness, I sideswiped that introduction and brought in another song completely unrelated to Cheapness, Invocation and Ritual Dance of the Young Pumpkin. So no one's ever heard that collage before. I can guarantee you it. No one would dare interrupt Frank. But I did, and that's what we just experienced, sideswiping Cheapness with something from a few years earlier. So now I must mute everybody.
All participants are now muted.
Connecting to the Cheapness.
Did you say it's, yes?
The Cheapness
of
America that became the uniform of the global
theater.
Solar salon.
Yeah, that's
Bob Salon.
Yeah.
His work making
the
market. The
title. Right, and you would think that's the meaning of the 1975 album, One Size Fits All. But you'll see in the Bob Marshall interview, Bob Marshall projected that meaning, and Frank said, no, it had another meaning. It didn't mean that. It didn't mean uniformity. It meant some other accommodating. It could be one Rumpelstiltskin could be, as a Tetra manager, could be many sizes and modulate the responses of the audience, the global co-creators in the global theater of the solar banking. It was something complex, more complex in the meaning, Frank said, rather than just a simple uniformity, everybody wearing the same uniform dictated by Roxy's grandparents. Yeah, who?
Yes, and today I would like to talk about the pedagogic and political side of Frank Zappa. And exploring this has been a real amazing trip.
Okay, but Roxy, I have something to.
It took me.
Something I want to read. Hold it, Roxy. I have something I want to read to you to see how this affects what you're going to present. Okay, because it is something that you agree with. But I happen to read a summary of the movie by Tim Carey, 1962, called "The World's Greatest Sinner," and Zappa did the. Some of the music for it, and I don't think he did all of the music, but and he talks about it on the famous bicycle performance on the Steve Allen Show. He says it's coming up next week, and Steve Allen is in March 1963, so the end of March is when I thought it was the premiere, but apparently it never had a complete premiere. It just would be performed or shown periodically in different theaters around the country or something. But this was a special one, and there's a picture of Frank on stage with Tim Carey, the director. Now, listen to this, Roxy. Our point is that Frank is anticipating, involved with things that anticipate Iandom. So listen to this. So here's the New York Times summary of the movie. Character actor and cult hero Timothy Carey wrote, produced, and directed this one-of-a-kind parade of the unusual, in which Tim Carey stars as Clarence Hilliard. I used to know a young hockey player in Nova Scotia, in Dartmouth, named Hilliard Graves, who was probably the first kid who ever made it to the National Hockey League that I know of that came out of Dartmouth, Nova Scotia. Now you have the best players in the NHL, Crosby, whatever his name is, Sidney Crosby, they came out of Dartmouth. Maybe they were coached by Hilliard. Got into the National Hockey League in the early 70s. But Clarence Hilliard, I'm always looking for connections to me. So in this parade of the unusual, one-of-a-kind parade of the unusual, in which Tim Carey stars as Clarence Hilliard, who is a seemingly content insurance salesman who undergoes a remarkable transformation. Hilliard, bored with his job and certain fate has bigger things in store for him, begins telling customers that insurance is pointless, which leads to him being fired. Now, this is the script. This movie was started to be made in the late 50s. I think it took him 4 or 5 years for Tim Curry to make it. So here is Tim Curry responding to the Global Theater brought in by the satellite, October 4th, 1957. Hilliard then declares that, quote, there's only one God, and that's man, unquote. And with the help of his loyal gardener, Alonzo, forms, dig this, the Eternal Man Political Party, and throws his hat into the political arena. It's based on a mandate that humans are eternal. That just sounds like us. Can you dig that, Roxy?
Yes.
isn't that amazing? Goodness. The Eternal Party. And so it says, to attract attention to his crusade, Hilliard learns to play guitar, and in brackets, well, sort of, hires a rock and roll band, and stages frenetic shows in which he throws himself about with a frantic abandon, like a cross between Gene Vincent and James Brown. So, like, he's taking off on the Elvis hip-shaking phenomenon, and whoever else jumped on that. What, Carol?
And Vito.
No, Vito hasn't performed yet. Vito and the Dancers don't show up till 64, 65, but he's predicting, yes, it's a good point, that Vito actually led the freakout scene in L.A. in the mid-60s. He was flinging himself about with frantic abandon, so this was anticipated by director Tim Curry, as this guy is, and you know, Tim Curry's a Hollywood actor in this period. He's performing in Stanley Kubrick's movies and making a unique imprint by himself. So, or from himself. So he is maybe satirizing the rock and roll, the new phenomenon that Elvis started, this what Wyndham Lewis called dithyrambic spectators, the spectator becoming dithyrambic. So it says Hilliard, excuse me, interruption there, another frequency came into my throat. I'll keep that down.
A ghost?
Beat that back. Yes, I'm beating that ghost back. Damn, ghost came in there for a second. All right. Hilliard drops the name Clarence and proclaims himself God and begins attracting a fanatical legion of followers. We've done that here. We've done that just as much here. Ion claims I'm, well, Moses' main right-hand man, the man behind Moses. All kinds of grandiose claims made here. And so Hilliard, the character, Hilliard, Clarence Hilliard, drops the name Clarence, proclaims himself God, and begins attracting a fanatical legion of followers. A mysterious political kingmaker offers his services to Hilliard. Could that be Ion? Could that be Ion? A mysterious political kingmaker offers his services to Hilliard, and God, meaning Hilliard, soon finds himself a serious contender for the office of President of the United States. That's part timely with our time this year, the Donald Trump, Ben Carson, everybody else of nobody reality trying to become president. That's happening this summer, this fall. A mysterious political kingmaker offers his services to Hilliard, and God soon finds himself a serious contender for the office of president of the United States. Growing crazed with his own power, Hilliard tells his followers that they are superhuman beings. In brackets, one who does not live up to Hilliard's high standards is forced to commit suicide. I don't know if that means one of them was, or in general that's a principle. He seduces both 70-year-old grandmothers and 14-year-old groupies and tells potential voters that if elected, he can make all people millionaires and bring eternal life to those who follow him. Does that sound like I do? That's what we've promised that to people, haven't we?
Yeah.
Well, we always have the proviso, though, from Ion, that you're already eternal and you're already a millionaire. You just don't realize it. So we have a default insurance or whatever the phrase is. So anyways, he's got a political party that's going to make everybody a millionaire and bring eternal life to all those who follow him. Certainly when I run for president or get noticed that I've been running for president for decades, I will be propagating that kind of dogma. Hilliard's long-neglected wife and children, that sounds like Carolyn, are taken aback by Clarence's transformation, urging him to turn his back on this blasphemous crusade and return to the Catholic faith of his earlier days. Remember that, Carolyn? Remember when you wanted me to return, to ignore Ion and go back to the old ways of whatever that was? maybe the Evergreens, Cosmic Awareness. So anyways, his long-neglected wife and children are hoping he'd go back and drop this fiasco. So Clarence, or God, facing a crisis of conscience, he challenges the supreme being to prove its existence. Then it says in this review by the New York Times, shot on a shoestring budget over a period of 4 years, the world's greatest sinner is, if anything, even more bizarre than a recounting of its plot would lead you to expect, and has inspired a surprisingly large fan following, considering the fact the film never received a nationwide release. Carey chose to distribute it himself. Frank Zappa, who was 22 when the film was released, composed the musical score and wrote the title song, quote, "As a sinner, he's a winner. Honey, he's no beginner," unquote. So if he composed the musical score, maybe he did everything. Noted voiceover artist Paul Frees narrates, and Ray Dennis Steckler, who later developed a cult following of his own for his movie called The Incredibly Strange Creatures Who Stopped Living and Became Mixed Up Zombies, Mr. Steckler was one of the cameramen. So they don't tell us what happened when Hilliard challenged the supreme being to prove his existence. But guess what? I saw this movie. You can't see it on YouTube. Tim Carey passed on in about 1994. He was a good friend of Jerry Fialka's. And Jerry Fialka used to say, once he became my mentor, Garrett Dean, that Garrett Dean was to me as Tim Carey was to Jerry. So he had some kind of nice relationship with Tim Carey. And Jerry got to know his son. So back in 97 or so, Tim Carey's son invited Jerry and I and Carolyn. Were you there, Carol?
Yeah.
Yeah. Out to his place in El Monte. You have there's a ghost again. Beat it back. It's like Zappa said in the intro to the cheapness. No.
Drink some water, Bob.
What, you want me to drink this water?
Is
it our special kind of water? Is it our special kind of water?
Yeah.
Yeah, it has the salt in it. Yeah, it's our water. It has salt in it. Imagine that, drinking salt-filled water. Who does that? Anyways, remember Zappa was in the little intro to cheapness? The guy had a bar, and it was visible on the screen, and so they were going, no, put it back, no. That's what I'm trying to do with the ghost here that's screwing up my voice. Carolyn's salt so far has not helped very much. You can see the ghost is still fighting it off. But what were we talking about? The world's greatest sinner so Tim Carey's son invited Jerry and I to his home where Tim Carey lived, and I don't know if he was living there when he made this, but it is the Carey household. And 3 years after Tim Carey has passed, and it's in El Monte, and in the early 60s, Zappa at the Studio Z, or maybe even before Studio Z, when Paul Buff was running the studio and Frank was learning from him out there in Cucamonga, they recorded a song by maybe the Penguins, I think it was. Memories of El Monte became a big hit. So it's interesting that this guy who makes this very conceptually continuous and relevant situation for Frank to use, because Frank did build on this movie. I asked Frank through the Evergreens, and we could suspect it anyways, but I checked with Frank after he'd passed on, and he confirmed that a lot of the themes in that movie are in his work. So watching it in Tim Carey's home was pretty interesting. And there was that picture that his son showed me of Frank standing there watching Tim Carey. It's the only photo of Frank looking like he's learning. He's there watching Tim Carey run the premiere, direct the audience, and Frank's standing back observing. Who took that picture? That's what's incredible. A very revealing picture. So there it was in the mantelpiece of Tim Carey's home, and I got to see that. So obviously I was meant to be connected to this movie because of those kind of circumstances of seeing it. Who can claim they saw the movie in Tim Carey's home, right? Who can do that, Roxy? I challenge you to come up with something. I mean, maybe you did that at Stockhausen's home. What, did you watch something Stockhausen made at his home? Did that happen to you, Roxy?
No. I only saw him at the Technisches Universität.
That's right. And he was hard to pay attention to. Yes, and he was always distracted himself. Okay, so do you get this point I'm making? a guy runs for president on the IONDEM platform of promising or guaranteeing everybody's eternal and that he'll make them millionaires. How much more? Now, what happens is things go awry after he gets proof or something happens when the Supreme Being. So we'll leave that for people to see. I don't think I should ruin the punchline. But it fits in with ION, the punchline, fits in with what we're about. And so I have thought about this movie every now and then, thought about it in terms of Frank, but I had not read a crystal clear prose version of the movie where they pointed out it was the Eternal Party, which I had forgotten. So with that's proof that Frank is connected to IONDEM, and all of his work, as your thesis is, as Roxy said many times, is that he was prefiguring John the Baptist for IONDEM. And can you imagine if any Zappa fans are listening to this right now, I don't know if any ever will, they're going to be shocked and hang up right at this point. Well, I trust, don't, I ask you, don't hang up. You're going to be surprised.
You know.
You got to do what Frank asked you to do. Relax and allow and freak out.
This is really interesting. How the cheapness of America became the environment, and how Frank and people that propose an alternative in the political forum, like LaRouche, try to fight this cheapness and try to show where is the solution to what is happening in the environment and the people becoming sick. Like LaRouche said, democracy is sick is a mistake, because they say the one that gets the most votes is the one that have to rule. But look, when people like the Bushes, the Daddy and Junior win, they may have the most votes, but that doesn't mean that they're the best ideas or the best for the people. So he thinks the system is sick. And the people, because of the cheapness that they consume from the environment. And he goes to criticize in a very serious way, and it's amazing that both LaRouche and Zappa see music as a very important part of their political agenda to solve the situation, to heal the environment and the people. And that's the amazing part of the whole situation.
How they overlap. How they overlap.
Yes, yeah, because LaRouche
in the night.
LaRouche,
let me say this, Roxy.
Saying,
hey, hold Roxy. Let me respond. Let me respond. LaRouche is saying that was what Mozart, Bach, and Beethoven were doing, and those great composers of the 19th century, right? But LaRouche says
yes,
it ends with Brahms.
I can explain his whole.
Okay.
Ideas, because he says.
Yeah.
The human, as an individual, is mortal, but the human species is eternal, and we have to find sense in what we're doing by connecting to the eternal, by connecting to the ideas that come from the beginning and create the progress. And that's why he went to study Leibniz and Bach, because that brings you back to Rixdorf. The King Friedrich der Zweite of France the Second of Prussia had a salon, and he was a very special character. Many say he was gay. He loved to play the flute, and he was actually more into philosophy and the arts. But his father was a real Prussian, and he wanted him to become a military. And he tried to escape with a friend when he was young, and the friend was killed because of treason. And then he married and became king, but he never had children. But he was a very tolerant very open-minded, and he brought the Bohemians that made Rixdorf, and they brought the ideas of Amos Comenius that said everybody, that education has to be universal and for everybody. And so...
And this is Frederick. Is this Frederick II? What's the name of this king?
Yeah. Yeah, Friedrich der Große.
Frederick II.
Yeah, that's in the 18th
Comenius.
Century.
We should make sure they hear the names. Comenius comes to Rixdorf, where you live in Berlin.
Amos Comenius was the first pedagogue. Yeah. He made the first book for teaching. And he said the environment is teaching you, the whole environment, nature, and not only the schools, and the schools should be for everybody, not only for the aristocrats. And he, the king, made the first public schools. And this is very interesting because at that time, there were the first experiments with electricity here in Berlin. And Franklin was aware of these things. And all these things happened in the Salon of the King. The Salon was like the internet of today, the place where the intellectuals and the art will get together and exchange ideas. And he also brought Voltaire.
Was Leibniz there? Was Leibniz there?
No, Leibniz was a very good friend of his grandmother. But he really knew about Leibniz and his ideas of that are similar to LaRouche, that men had to connect to the big human traditions to make their work meaningful, to have a sense in their life. Yeah. Otherwise, there is no sense. And Bach was also a student of Leibniz and Kepler. And he brought Bach to the court in Potsdam, and he had a way of entertaining himself, the king. He would give Bach some music ideas, and Bach had to develop them as fugues.
Really?
And this is from a idea from Leipzig, from Leibniz, I'm sorry. He said, you have to develop your mind using these tools, and music was a very important tool to develop all the capabilities of your mind and show what you could do. And Bach was like the master of this. He will get a pattern, and he will make all types of variations of the musical melody, the rhythm, like inversions, and all types of changes that to show the capabilities of the human mind. So he wrote his theories, the Well-Tempered Clavier and the Art of the Fugue, from these ideas of Leibniz and the place he had with the king, their entertainment. And LaRouche went to these ideas because he says to face the challenges we have now, the only way to solve these problems is to develop the mind. And music is not entertainment. Music is the only tool in which you can use your whole brain. And through music, you can learn how to, you get a pattern, how to play with it and expand on that. And it's the same with ideas. It can be a melody, but it can also be, it's what you do. And Bach was amazing because he went to study the tradition from the Greeks. The Greeks saw that there was some type of correspondence between the notes and the planets. And that's why in the middle of the scale is Sol, the note, which is the sun, because everything is like rotating around the sun. And Kepler went to study these ideas of how, because he wanted to understand how God's power works, and to understand the power of God, they had to understand this intelligence that is in nature, the mathematics and the music. And they also, since antiquity, God as a composer.
God as a composer,
Bach,
yeah.
Bach was fascinated with these ideas that the acoustic is reflected in the visual space, in the space.
Yeah.
And he went to make the well-tempered clavier, the division of the clavier in 12 equal intervals in the notes. And this reflects the cosmic, because he said this is a way to, like, to praise God. And when you use this system, you're actually using, like, the cosmic.
So the laws of
this is
universal laws of God.
Yes, because Kepler wanted to understand why the planets move like they move, and he discovered then gravity and the elliptical